This is going to be a long story, so I encourage you to sit back. To give a little background information, I'm from a city in the northeast of Scotland, in the UK. What happened here didn't just affect me, but also two close friends, who for the purposes of the story, we'll call Debbie and Joe. We all used to work for the Virgin Megastore, and for those of you that aren't old enough to remember, Virgin was where you'd go for tapes, CDs, movies, and pretty much any form of media up until the mid to late 2000s. I started there back in 2003, Debbie joined in 2006, and Joe came aboard in 2007. For the most part, the entire staff of the store were all close friends. We were all music and movie nerds, so we shared the same interests and sense of humor. Every year over the Christmas holiday, we would take on temporary staff as extra help for the volume of customers we would get. In 2007, one of our temps was named Rory, and unlike Debbie and Joe, this isn't a pseudonym. Most of us hit it off with Rory brilliantly. Young guy, seemed really passionate about music, especially Pink Floyd, which was a big win with Joe, who is one of the greatest guitarists that I've ever met personally, and myself, who grew up on Pink Floyd through my parents. Plus, Rory was a budding filmmaker, and his love of movies seemed to match his love for music. So we had a lot to chat about, and became friends very quickly. It was rare to keep in touch with the work temps post the Christmas period, but Rory was an exception to this. He didn't live in the same city as the rest of us, but kept plenty of contact through text and social media, and would come through to the city to hang out from time to time. Moving forward to Christmas of 2008, by this point, Virgin Megastore had become Zavi Entertainment, and Rory came back to work with us as a temp again. Specifically, he'd be working under me. I ran the stockroom of the store, which was the busiest place at Christmas time, and had a history of not great people to help for how much work had to be done. So I was happy to be getting someone I knew would work hard, and that I could have banter with. He could be a bit annoying trying to force different live versions of the same Pink Floyd song he'd found on the internet. As I said, I love Pink Floyd, but I love a lot of other music as well. Nevertheless, I just figured, he's young, and he's passionate, but he's cool. Around this time, he started to put together a self-made Pink Floyd documentary, which he interviewed me and Joe for. And to be honest, he did a f***ing great job given the limited tools that he had. Zavi closed in February of 2009, due to the global credit crunch at the time. All the Zavi staff and Rory kept in touch. We'd all become very close working there. Fast forward to summer of 2010, we had a Zavi reunion night out, which Rory organized. Most of us that still lived in the same city managed to make it along. It was a really fun night out, and Rory stayed at my place. Rory was preparing to go to America for his second year working as a camp counselor for Camp America at Camp Wigwam in Maine, Ohio. Since Zavi closed, I'd gotten a new job doing the same thing at another entertainment retail store. And that Christmas, Rory came to work there as a temp, which I was initially fine with. Moving into 2011, Rory starts to raise red flags, although at the time, I didn't see them clearly. He claimed that while in America, he'd gotten a job helping with editing and camera work on the show Burn Notice. At the time, I was like, wow, that's cool, man. Well done. It didn't seem unbelievable, given I knew he had talent in filmmaking. To coincide with this, he claimed he was working for Camp America in Florida, which is what led him to work on Burn Notice, where it was at the time filmed. Then, when he was back in Scotland in 2011, it was time for another Zavi reunion, which Rory had to be in charge of. Which bothered me, as he technically didn't work there when we closed. And like I said, he was only ever a temp anyway. I got sickened with him posting constantly on Facebook about essentially what was just some old friends going to the pub. Again, I was just like, yeah, he's young and easily excited. He's harmless though. But then another red flag was raised. Rory and another friend who shared an interest in filmmaking were talking about doing a film in the city. They spent the whole day looking at locations. And afterwards, when I spoke to Rory, he was like, "Yeah, we're going to do this, and this, and this," making it sound like they had some real exciting ideas. But then when I spoke to another one of my friends about it, he told me all Rory did for the whole day was ask me about my favorite directors. It was a complete waste of time. Made me think, once again, he's young and excitable and has a tendency to exaggerate, but still, he's harmless. Move on to 2012. Debbie, who I mentioned at the start of this story, became a closer figure in Rory's life. Debbie is nearly 6 feet tall. She's blonde and the definition of a bombshell. At the time, she was one of the nicest people you could ever meet, with an amazing sense of humor. We became super close when we worked together, but it was never anything other than platonic. I always looked at her in more of a sibling way. She would come round to my place for dinner and to watch movies, and I knew all her close friends and a few family members. Herself and Rory went to the cinema a few times and hung out afterwards. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. For now. Move on to Christmas time. Rory's back as a temp for the third year in a row, and by this time, he has started to annoy the other staff. While on lunch, he'd sit and brag about all the TV shows he'd worked on during summers in the States. Burn Notice, Criminal Minds, and The Wire. Unfortunately, I didn't hear about this at the time, because people knew I was friendly with him. They didn't want to seem like they were talking shit about him, as the staff in this job also got along famously. On a personal note, talking with him at work became a bit weird. He started talking to me in a really smug and condescending tone, which, given the fact that I'm 6 years older than the dude and had a hand in him getting his temp jobs every year, I didn't really appreciate it. Then, around the same time, there's another Zavi night out due. Rory, Debbie, Joe, who is now visiting from his new home in Glasgow, along with myself and a few others. The day before the said get-together, keeping in mind, I'm pissed about how Rory is behaving, I get a text from him saying, "Hey man, the plan for the night out tomorrow is to go to the pub quiz. Your favorite." Now, I don't go to pub quizzes for tedious personal reasons, and all these friends knew this. So Rory was essentially implying the rest of the guys had planned to go to something I wouldn't go to, which I didn't, as I was super pissed about that text. I kept quiet about it from the others, even though I should have known how devious he was, because, as it turns out, those guys didn't go to a pub quiz, and there was no intention to. The next day, Joe comes into the shop to speak to me, since I'd missed the night out. The whole time I'm talking to him, Rory is standing next to him, in a defensive stance, answering just about everything that I asked Joe, like he was Joe's f***ing spokesperson, which was infuriating. But because I was at work, I couldn't lose my shit. And Joe is happy-go-lucky. He didn't even notice what Rory was doing. Rory was obsessed with Joe because of his talents as a guitar player, to the point of it becoming unhealthy. It was around this time that Debbie started to sense I was having a problem with Rory. And it was true. Contact with him would trigger me to get anxious or angry because I knew there was just something amiss. But Debbie and Joe were constantly fooled by his false charm. And that's why I kept tolerating him, because I loved those guys and didn't want to be the cause of any drama. In early 2013, Rory tells us that his dad had a life-threatening stroke, which he survived, but left him incredibly disabled. But this subsequently turns out to be a lie and a tool to get sympathy from both Debbie and Joe. Moving forward to 2014, Joe moves back to town from Glasgow, into Debbie's spare room, and this is where Rory really starts to phase me out from the group. Despite having recently hung out with me and me having to put up with him at my place, which I had done several times over the years to this point, he takes Debbie, Joe, and another ex-Zavi friend to 3 Prince shows around the country. Initially, I was super pissed, but in hindsight, I was relieved. It was Rory that paid for all the tickets for those gigs, which was another red flag. I have to point out that when he wasn't working with me as a temp over Christmas, or in America over the summer working for Camp America and various TV shows, he put on that he was a freelance photographer and video editor, which would be fine, but he didn't have a website, a Facebook page, or anything else as far as I could see to contact him to do said work. Taking that into account, and the fact that he's throwing cash to go to concerts around the UK, I was concerned about where his money was coming from. Following the Prince gigs, I had blocked him on all social media, as his posts and comments on other people's posts were just annoying, constantly undermining people on what they're saying, or arguing with folks having a different opinion from him. Debbie took issue with me blocking him, and stuck up for him, which in hindsight, shows that she'd been groomed by him, and had rose-tinted glasses on whilst looking at him. I caved and got back in touch with him, even though I know I should have walked away from them all. But like I said before, I dearly loved Debbie and Joe and didn't want to lose their friendship, even though I knew deep down there was something bad about Rory. Throughout 2014, Debbie and Rory continued to get super close. Anyone that didn't know them and just saw the Facebook pics would think they were a couple. Over the next 2 years, my contact with these guys started to drift. Rory would come around to my place for a bit, and then when leaving be like, "I'm away up to Darling Debbie's. I would invite you, but you're not one of the three amigos." This became a running phrase for him, but a lot of the time, I learned that he was actually never going to see Debbie. He came to my place to stay the night once, saying he needed to catch a flight to the States in the morning to a video editing job. Then it would turn out he was just going back to the village he lived in, to his mom's house. Eventually, I walked away quietly. I took Debbie, Joe, and Rory off of my newsfeed and decided to make any Facebook posts that I made hidden from them. I figured if I see any of them on the street, I'll be polite and just go my separate way ASAP. I started to investigate Rory's claims about his time in America, though. I relayed them all to a friend and his flatmate, who he himself had lived in America for a long time. They both told me, "Nah, man, there's no way he could be doing all that shit." Which is true. If you go to America to work for Camp America, that's all you're allowed to do. And with a bit of research, I found the camp Rory actually worked at, proving he never did Camp America work in Florida. During this time, I had friends who would still follow him on Facebook, just out of intrigue. They would ask me, "Where is his money coming from?" Rory was going to stadium and arena concerts around the UK at least once a week. Some of the gigs cost as much as £200, not to mention travel costs and accommodation. I knew that something was up. I knew that he wasn't involved in drugs. He would claim he made money from YouTube, but his channel barely had any subscriptions. And plus, all of his videos were of copyrighted material, so there was no way he was making money on that. I did wonder if he was making money from editing. He was avoiding paying tax. That's the only thing I could think of. Believe me, if I could have afforded a private detective to investigate this guy, I would have gladly done that. During all of this time, though, Debbie and Joe are hanging out with and posting how great he is on Facebook, despite the fact that I found Rory had a second Facebook account where the profile pic was of him and Debbie. This was his secret account, and I took a screenshot to show Debbie, but she was just like, "Oh, isn't that his American account?" Sorry, Debbie, but you were really f***ing stupid. Now let's fast forward to October of 2018. By this point, I've severed pretty much all contact with Rory. I've missed Debbie's wedding the previous year, where Rory was a bridesman, and I hadn't seen Joe in a good while either. I'm back at work after lunch for about 5 minutes, when my friend, who is on her lunch and in the staff room, comes running through to where I am. "Hey, have you heard Rory was in court?" Which, in and of itself, was initially shocking. I was like, "What, for tax evasion or copyright infringement?" "No," she said, "for making videos of little kids." You see, between January and November of 2017, he was pretending to be a girl online using YouTube and Omegle to groom young boys. Once I was told what he'd done, I was in an adrenaline-fueled rage for the next 17 hours or so. Just so pissed off that I'd been right about him being a bad guy. I just couldn't prove it. I knew my friends had been duped. Not to mention all those poor kids that were abused by him. As for his expendable income, I really think he was selling the videos he was making on the dark web for Bitcoin profit. He was the first person ever to mention the dark net to me, but in a way of like, oh, never go to the dark net. Rory ended up pleading guilty and got 3 years and 9 months, along with a 5-year sexual harm prevention order, and he'll be on the sex offenders register for the rest of his life. I want to thank you for listening to this story. It's helped me a lot to get it off my chest. I'm still in touch with Joe, although he's a super busy guy these days. Debbie, unfortunately, I'm not in touch with now. I know she was mortified by the revelations, but she's happy and married. So I'm just glad she saw the truth eventually, even though it took something so heinous to do so. Alright, so this story takes place a few years back. I was maybe 16 or 17 years old at the time. I'm 22 now. I used to work at a well-known fast food restaurant. I typically had to work the closing shift since I had school earlier in the day. So by the time I got home, it was usually around 11:30 p.m. I had my own car at this time, and when I got off of work, I used to like to sit in my car, recline the driver's seat back, listen to music, and just chill out. I used to do this because I have helicopter parents, so this was the only real alone time I got without being hovered around. Well, one particular night, I was exhausted. I got stuck with the slow closers, so I got home a little later than normal. I started up my normal routine of sitting in my car, but instead of listening to music and scrolling through my phone, I leaned back and closed my eyes. I didn't fall asleep or anything. I was just listening to myself breathe while taking in the silence of my own company. I don't remember how long I was lying back with my eyes closed, but suddenly I bolted up and saw my mom with an angry face waving frantically at me. She was gesturing at me to come to her immediately. I sighed and hurried out of the car towards her. I would like to add that my parents like to drink, so she was pretty inebriated when I approached her. She grabbed me by the shoulders and hissed, "Who's out there with you?" Confused, I shook her off. "No one, Mom. I was just sitting in my car by myself before I came in." I remember feeling a little annoyed because I thought I was going to get in trouble, but her face soon turned from angry to concerned. "What? Someone was out here. They were looking in at you through your window. I came outside because I had a funny feeling, and when they saw me, they just took off into the neighbor's yard." She was slurring her words together terribly and was visibly shaking. Being the teenager that I was, I just rolled my eyes and took her inside. At that moment, I just thought she was a drunk, overprotective parent who got worried that I wasn't inside the house at my normal time. The next morning rolls around, I do my normal school routine, kiss my parents goodbye, and as I'm unlocking my car door, I notice something that stops me dead in my tracks. I felt a cold sweat creep up on me, with a chill sliding down my spine. A forehead and 2 forearm prints were on my driver's side window. I never sat in my car after work again after that. I think about it from time to time, wondering about what would have happened had my mother not come outside to check where I was. Whoever that was that person looking into my car to break into it? Did they notice me completely defenseless and were trying to scare me? I have no idea, but I'm glad that I never found out. We once had a family friend named Ron. Ron was weird, vulgar, and broken. Unfortunately, like many men in the military can be. We knew he had a sordid past, and we knew his upbringing was strange to say the least. But overall, he seemed like a harmless man. My husband Ben went to the same post-boot camp school as Ron. He and a handful of boys were bonded by the shitty conditions and even shittier higher-ups while attending school. Ben married me while on leave. We've been together a long time and known each other much longer than that. Eventually, we moved into an apartment together at his duty station in Southern California. It was wonderful. Ron would come around occasionally and spend weekends with Ben. Sometimes he'd even sleep in our home, on the sofa, or on an air mattress in the living room. Eventually, we moved to a larger house on the military base, and Ron had to deploy to Japan. It was a long 6 months. Life went on normally without him. Friends came and went. This isn't a particularly unique situation. Ultimately, Ben's turn to deploy would come. It was hard to cope, but fine. We said our goodbyes, smooched, and he was off to strengthen his sea legs for the next 6 months. When Ron returned to California, just 1 week after Ben deployed, he wanted to pick up a box of his things from our home we had tucked away for safekeeping for him. I was excited to see the familiar face. He picked up his things, shared a little small talk, and left. Nothing strange at all, honestly. Knowing he was back from his journey and many of his friends were deployed with Ben, I extended some kind and friendly words over Facebook Messenger occasionally, wishing him well, being polite. Unfortunately for the both of us, he mistook my kindness as romantic gestures. One night, around 2 a.m., Ron called me via Facebook's calling feature. Concerned for him, I answered. I thought the worst. Had he become depressed? Maybe suicidal? I can't in good conscience deny a listening ear to someone who maybe needed it, especially someone my husband is somewhat fond of. The conversation started somewhat normal as a strange, unwarranted 2 a.m. call could be. He was loud, possibly drunk, and sounded desperate for conversation. He rambled on for a while, then admitted to me that as a child, he had had a sexual relationship with his younger stepsister. He talked in a lot of circles, but a few statements that stood out to me were, "I just can't trust myself around women, especially alone. I've always liked you. I think you're hot, and I remember the way you looked in your bikini at the beach." During this conversation, where I should have just hung up on him, I made several attempts to keep the content friendly and uplifting, assuming that he was having some sort of episode. It was all horrible, and it made me feel disgusting. He then told me that he was near my house, at another girl's house, I assume with some poor guy's awful cheating wife. He said she wasn't really anything to him, and he wanted to come over to my house. He knew that Ben was an ocean away, and that I was all alone at home. I told him explicitly to not come, and that's when he hung up on me. I panicked and closed all of the first floor windows and doors, making sure that they were all locked. I turned off the lights as well. I took my dog and cat up to my bedroom and locked that door too, wedging pieces of furniture into the door to create a barricade of sorts. Lo and behold, he showed up. He walked all around my house, pulling on the doors, calling my phone, messaging me horrible things. I screamed for him to leave both on the phone and through my upstairs window. It was really a nightmare, realized. "I could get in if I really wanted to," he messaged me, a clear threat, in my own opinion. I called the police, then I called my neighbor, a big Navy doc, who I feel that I owe my life to. After being chased off by my neighbor and having long talks with PMO, NCIS, and my neighbors, I received a protection order against Ron. I'm disappointed there wasn't any brig time for the fucker, but I'm pleased I have documented evidence in case he ever tries to contact me or my husband again. You never really know someone. I guess that's the moral of this story. Stay safe, friends, and exercise your right to bear arms if you so choose.